Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Statements and opinions by guests of Mysterious Radio are not to be considered as endorsed by sponsors or affiliated networks. Any rebroadcast, reproduction, or other use of this podcast without the express written consent of Mysterious Radio is strictly prohibited.
Get ready for a night filled with conspiracies, strange places, the paranormal, UFOs, legends, and myths from around the world. With your hosts, K-Town, on Mysterious Radio.
All right, thank you for joining me tonight for another edition of Mysterious Radio. I'm your host, K-Town. I hope that you've had a great weekend. We've been really busy over here trying to get things organized. We need a lot of help. I know that organizing's not my strongest asset. It's just not something I like to do. But before we get started, I really need to go backtrack, and it's my fault, and recognize our newest Mysterious Radio Truthers. Let me go ahead and recognize these people because they are the reason why you're even getting a free show. They allow us to do this. Without them, I'd be working somewhere, not doing what I'm doing now. So let's give thanks to these people. The first one I have is Bill Toole, Tyson McKinney, Kevin Stendel. I hope I said that correctly, Kevin. If I didn't, forgive me. Let's see here. Gary Curtis, Wesley Etheridge, Rachel Ortez De La Pina, Delilah Ramirez, Angela Morales, Holly M. Cannot pronounce that last name. Patty Salem, Joe, Natalia Garza, Judy Watson, and then we have Allison, Cynthia Blanche, Heather Williams, Jennifer V, can't pronounce that either, Denise Kennebec, Emily Smith, Dana Johnson, Charles K, Karen Callahan, Davy Dell, Sir William Cooper, I like that, okay, Emily Ward, Karen Long, Mel Johnson, Daniel Barnett, Nick T, can't pronounce that last name, sorry about that, Nick, C. Wheat, Nick Merchant, and Tracy Bozzelli. I want to thank all of you for becoming Mysterious Radio Truthers. You have an opportunity to connect with me via message on there. So if you have any issues at all, please send me a message and I'll make sure to get back with you and help you with any issues or concerns that you may have, okay? And for those that have signed up for the promotion, your Area 51 signs and all your rewards for those that are up for them are being sent out, okay? We sent out a ton over the past 2 weeks, so and thank you for letting me know that you've received them. So they are on the way. All right, so, but anyway, tonight we're going to be talking about UFOs. And my special guest is William Puckett, and he keeps up with these things in a fantastic way. He has several websites. We'll give those to you. As we get into the show, I will have William on here as a continuous guest, you know, to come on and talk about some of the most amazing sightings from around the country. If you like true crime, I'm going to invite you to subscribe. Please subscribe to my other show. It's called Seven, and it was the X Podcast, but I'm not doing it anymore. I've totally rebranded that show to be strictly a true crime podcast where I interview the best true crime writers in the world on some of the most prolific murders and homicides of the 20th century. So if that's something that you like, please subscribe to it and join me for that every week. I'll release a show, a new show every week. All right. All right. So we're going to get to it. Here now is my special guest, William Puckett, to discuss UFO sightings. All All right, my special guest tonight is William Puckett, and we're going to be talking about his extensive research into the UFO and alien phenomena. So I'm very glad to have you on the show tonight, William. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, and I look forward to discussing the O'Hare incident and any other UFO cases, X-Files, paranormal events that you'd like to talk about.
All right, very good. So looking at your website, and I know you have three different ones here, and let me tell my listeners about that. You have UFOSNW.com. What does that stand for?
UFOs Northwest.
There you go. Okay. All right. And then you got UFOSightingsMontana.com. Also, you have ReportAUFOSighting.com. Is that correct?
That's correct. That last site is pretty much devoted to fielding reports from people. And they can report to me via the website, or if they're on a cell phone, it will redirect to a cell phone site that makes it user friendly, and they can report their sightings to me via cell phone. So got a lot of ways people can report their sightings to me, but primarily my main blog is the UFO Northwest site, and that contains almost all my reports. And then also I have archive reports, which I'll get to on that particular site. My site is kind of a twosome site, where as of January 1st, 2011, I went to a new format, namely the WordPress format. So, but people can get to all those reports. And the one that we're talking about tonight is on the older site, the O'Hare incident, which I did quite a bit of research for.
Okay, so before we get into this stuff, William, why don't you tell us, because you're knee deep in it now. Seriously, I'm very impressed and I love it. And I encourage anyone who's interested in this to visit all three of the sites. So tell us about yourself and how you got started.
I was raised here in Montana, and growing up in the 1950s, there was just a UFO craze out there, and there was a lot of panic in the public. And, you know, it kind of got me interested then, you know, when the Russians launched Sputnik. And shortly after Sputnik, there was a real major sighting that really reached into the media. It was a Loveland, Texas sightings, where all these lights were seen and car engines turned off. And that was right after Sputnik. That was November 1957. So that's kind of how I got interested. And then fast forward in the 1970s, when Project Blue Book was declassified, and I read a book about it and said, well, there was 11,000 reports since nearly 800 of them were unidentified. And I said, wow, that's a lot. It only takes one, you know. And so I started reading about it. And then in the 1980s, a lot of the cable channels started picking up UFO documentaries. And, you know, I'm listening to people do it and said, heck, you know, I got a scientific background. I can do this. So in the 90s, 1997 is when I actually started investigating UFOs. The very first thing I investigated was a Majestic 12 documents. I won't go into it in detail, but I received them from a guy at work, and they were really old. They were yellow documents. And I don't know whether your listeners are familiar, but the Majestic 12 documents were leaked to Jamie Sherra and William Moore in 1984 via 35 millimeter film, and subsequent to that, Stanton Friedman and Robert Wood and Ryan Wood and other people kind of got their feet in the research of them. But these seem to be an independent leak. That was my first investigation, really. And then fast forward a few more years, 2003, I bought up my website. That's when I started. And then since then, I've collected thousands of reports, probably tens of thousands of reports. And even since January 1st of 2011, when I started using the WordPress format, I've collected nearly 3,600 UFO reports. So, you know, they're coming in. They kind of slow up and speed up. And, you know, I did some investigation for other agencies. You mentioned at the beginning of your show, NARCAP, and I did work with them. And then also as Montana director for MUFON in two separate instances for a couple of years. Then I resigned, and then a few more years, I picked it up again for two more years. And right now I'm not in MUFON anymore. At least I'm not I'm not state director, and I'm not doing any investigations for them. I have a hard enough time getting my own reports up there. I mean, as I'm speaking tonight, I'm looking at reports that haven't been filed yet. They're filed on the website. So I'm always probably a dozen reports behind in the filing. So I kind of like to give attention to the best reports, particularly the PICTO reports, PICTO meaning videos, sketches, you know, photos, forensic evidence, whatever I can get my hands on. I like to give more attention to those particular reports. So that's kind of a synopsis of how I get interested in UFOs and, you know, why I've continued to do the research. I keep looking for the sighting that's going to give me incontrovertible evidence that ET is here, or maybe not ET, maybe higher dimensional beings. You know, we don't really know what they are, who they are, but I'm still looking for that killer case. I've had some pretty good cases, but probably none that, you know, could be 100% incontrovertible, unexplainable. But some I'd put in the 97, 98 percentile rank. So that's kind of a conclusion, you know, of an overview of my involvement in the UFO field. And I am a scientist, and, you know, as a weather forecaster, and I was an air quality specialist in Environmental Protection Agency. I do have quite a bit of expertise in weather and aviation radar. A lot of the work I've done is that I've done work for other people with aviation radar. Right now I'm helping MUFON with a case where allegedly there were ladybugs in Southern California that created quite a stir amongst the FAA, Federal Aviation Administration. So I'm helping them unformat that radar data. So that's kind of a, you know, overview of my association with UFOs.
That's amazing. I do want to come back and talk about your expertise as far as the weather is concerned, because a lot of that's used to dismiss these UFO sightings. So we're going to come back to that in just a moment. Here, William, you said something about Project Blue Book. Now, I listen to a lot of interviews, Linda Moulton Howe. Now, she talked about the Project Blue Book documents, and I heard her, I think she was talking to Richard Dolan, that they believe that those documents were not real. Somehow they were faked, and having those looked at by people that would actually have, you know, are familiar with how these documents would be presented, they just didn't look real as far as the stamps and dates and things like that. Have you heard that, or what are your thoughts on it?
Well, my thoughts about that is, of course, there's a lot of UFO or Majestic 12 documents. It started with the Eisenhower briefing document, which right after Dwight Eisenhower was elected, November 1952, he was briefed before he became president. And that's the first documents that leaked. But the problem is there's been so many other documents leaked, like recovery manual, how to recover extra biological entities. And, you know, that a lot of these other documents quite likely are fabrications. Whether or not the Eisenhower briefing document is a fabrication, I don't know. I just know that the document that I had, which got lost, by the way, not by me, but by the researcher doing evidence or research on it. We did a lot of work on ink, watermarks, and a number of things. And it seemed like it was the real deal, that, you know, it wasn't just a fabrication, but I really don't know. Of course, a lot of these documents were leaked by Richard Dotti for the Office of Special Investigations out of Albuquerque, New Mexico, the Air Force. And Richard Dotti is a disinformation agent. he talks out of both sides of his mouth, and you don't know what he's telling you, if it's fact about UFOs or if it's misleading with UFOs. And I know that Linda Moulton Howe has had quite a bit of contact with him, and he has misled her on a number of occasions amongst other people. So I wouldn't hang my hat on Majestic 12, and I wouldn't say that just because they are fakes, if they really are, that that would totally dismiss the UFO phenomenon, because our government, you know, particularly the intelligence agencies and other special agencies, we've got so many agencies in the federal government that have classified information. Part of the intelligence is to do disinformation, and that's what they do. But you don't know how much of that's fact and how much of it's fiction. So I just can't give you a concrete answer on Majestic 12. Stanton Friedman, he believed that the Eisenhower briefing document was a real deal. The rest of them, he said, was fabrication. That's what he told me once when I talked to him at a MUFON conference. Of course, Stanton passed away about a year ago, I believe. But this was, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago when I talked to him. And that's what he told me. And under his breath, he said, "Don't tell Bob," meaning Bob Wood, because Bob Wood is one that has authenticated, allegedly, a lot of these other Majestic 12 documents. So, you know, they could very well be part of a disinformation campaign. I mean, all the people on Majestic 12, I mean, there was quite a cast of cronies on there, you know, when you look at them. And Donald Menzel, for one. And Donald Menzel was a professor at, I think, either Illinois or Northwestern University. I don't know for sure. Well, Donald Menzel publicly was a UFO debunker, but he was allegedly a member of Majestic 12. Now, I met one of Donald Menzel's students, Marilyn Childs, who's a PhD, and she was pretty young when she knew Donald Menzel. And Donald Menzel and her, this is kind of funny, they used to go out to the graveyard and park in his car and eat lunch, and he'd tell her all about UFOs. And then publicly, he was debunking UFOs. So here you go, you know, two sides of the mouth. What side do you believe? But, you know, that's what Marilyn said. So he was a member, and, you know, there was James Forrestal, the first Secretary of Defense under Harry Truman, of course, allegedly jumped from Walter Reed Hospital, seventh or eighth story. A lot of people think he was pushed. He left no suicide note. He was suffering from depression, which is why he was hospitalized. Allegedly, James Forrestal saw one of the Roswell aliens. So, and that, you know, so, you know, those are two members. I can't remember all of the other ones. I mean, I'd have to Nathan Twining was another member, General Twining. He wrote the Twining document, which is kind of famous, where he kind of talked about UFOs as being unidentified. His son, Nate Jr., has often talked about how his father really was a member. So, you know, you can just kind of make up your own mind about it. As far as UFOs go, I wouldn't, in my mind, spend a whole lot of time thinking about MJ-12. You know, it probably has little relevance on current sightings, you know, but what do I believe there was an MJ-12? I just don't know for sure. I mean, the people that they picked, you know, that allegedly on the list is, I mean, it is an interesting cast of characters, you know, scientists and military people and government officials, you know, quite a cross section.
Right.
But certainly well qualified people. And I can't remember who was the last one to die. I mean, they've been dead for quite a few years. I mean, we're talking, I mean, I'm 72, and this all happened allegedly in late 1947. Allegedly, Harry Truman appointed him. So, but,
well, let me ask you this. So is there any place online that you know of that we can look at the Eisenhower briefing documents?
Well, I have a report on my site about what work I did on MJ-12. I mean, people can look at that. And I updated the research that I was doing until the documents got lost. And they can go to my site. I don't know, probably John Greenwald, The Black Vault, has information on MJ-12. And I actually, on the Paracast, on my community forum, I've got a thread on MJ-12, which people can go to on the Paracast, www.theparacast.com, because I discussed Majestic 12 with them, because Nick Redfern, who's another UFO researcher, we talked about Majestic 12, and he has some expertise on MJ-12 himself. And my recollection was that somehow or another, and I really can't remember exactly what he said about it, but he thought there was a Russian connection to MJ-12, that he kind of hinted that it was disinformation, but it was interesting disinformation, put it that way.
That's interesting.
On my website, the quickest way to find something is, just use a search engine on my site. And the MJ-12, which is on my older site, that's all the research I did, which was quite a few years ago that I did that research on that. And I've got the copy of the documents. Stanton Friedman was involved in that because I got those documents from a coworker, and he knew I was interested in UFOs. And he approached me about it, and his grandfather lived in Southern California, and I was working in Washington State at the time. I was at played in the Environmental Protection Agency in Seattle. And his grandfather had faxed him these documents, and Chris, the name of my coworker, said, "Well, where'd you get them?" And he said, "Got them from a government official many, many years ago." So he asked me about it, and his grandfather's mailed him the documents, and I looked at them, and they were old and yellow looking and had been in his file a long time. So I contacted Dr. Robert Wood, and I said, because Dr. Wood was kind of the lead researcher at the time, and I sent him the documents. And then he did a lot of work, with ink and watermarks and everything. And we kind of determined that they were independent documents from the Jamie Sherrod, William Moore, 35 millimeter documents, and which made it all the more interesting. Where else did they come from? But Stanton Friedman, I contacted him, and he interviewed my coworker's grandfather and really couldn't get much more out of him. I mean, the guy was in his mid-80s at the time. You can't expect anybody in their mid-80s to be, really totally lucid and have a sharp recollection. But he said he got them from a government official. And I will add that Chris's grandfather worked on the Manhattan Project in World War II. He worked on the shielding for the atomic bomb at Caltech. So I don't think that it had any connection with, the MJ-12, but it's still interesting, when you start, you put out the dots and then start drawing lines between the dots. And sometimes you kind of wonder really what's going on,
Right, so, right. You've looked at this phenomenon for a very long time. Between the current reports that you're getting and some of those early ones, vintage reports from the 40s, 50s, 60s? Which ones do you find the most impressive?
That's a good question. You know, I personally think that UFO reports that are coming out, you know, the recent, I mean, within the last 5 years, are probably just as compelling, if not more compelling, than what we saw 70 plus years ago. The difference being, we got a few variables in the equation here. First off, let's go back to the late 40s, the summer of 1947, when Kenneth Arnold reported the UFOs over Mount Rainier, between Mount Adams and Mount Rainier. I mean, in 1947, we just barely had jet aircraft. I mean, you know, the sound barrier was just broken shortly. I can't remember when it was. I think shortly after Kenneth Arnold's sighting. I think it was that fall. And so we didn't have many aircraft around, not a lot of things flying in the sky. A few Horton flying wings, which could be mistaken for UFOs. But, you know, we didn't have good camera equipment in those days. We had less things flying around. So when people did see something unusual, it could have very well been a UFO. Well, nowadays, I mean, we got drones, lots of secret military aircraft, you know, high altitude balloons, you know, just a lot of variety of things. Even these blimps that, you know, Google is putting up for high speed internet, you know, these things all can spur UFO reports. But nowadays, we got much better technology. I mean, cell phones take high definition videos and everybody has a cell phone. So somebody sees something, they flip their cell phone out there and take video or photo of it. So we have better technology, but also we got a lot more noise in the data, namely with a lot more stuff flying around that could be construed as UFOs. And then also we got really nifty software out there, where you can fake UFOs. I mean, I used to subscribe to Skeptical Inquirer because I'm kind of interested in the other fact. I mean, you know, people, I mean, reputable scientists like Bill Nye, the science guy, and Dr. Michael Shermer and those type of people, you know, they're holding us to the grindstone of, you know, scrutinizing what we're doing. But, you know, I found this iPhone app that Dr. Shermer talked about. I put it on my iPhone, and you can take a really good photo, and then you just drag a nice looking UFO on top of it and put a few shadows on it and everything, and boy, you got the real deal, you know? And so I think new reports, there are some really good ones, and particularly the video of, you know, these talked about, you know, off the coast of California. Catalina Island, the Tic Tac UFOs, you know, those are military sightings and quite likely are the real deal. And so there are good reports coming out now, but we got more noise in them. But, you know, in a sense, I can empathize why the Air Force officially got out of UFOs in 1969. Of course, with Luis Elizondo, we know that they funded other UFO projects as of recent. But back in 1969, when the Condon report came out, University of Colorado, the Air Force said, well, we can't justify doing UFO research anymore, and they put the plug on it. Well, they were getting a lot of reports, too, that weren't the real deal. I mean, Venus, Jupiter, the space station, I mean, well, they didn't get reports of the space station. So many reports I get are readily explainable. You wouldn't believe the number of reports I get of Venus and Jupiter. It's just unbelievable. And even the space station. And Venus can show up in the daytime. If you take a video and, you know, high definition video and you see it looks like a silver object, it's Venus sometimes. I mean, not always. I mean, there's UFOs flying around that are silver too. So I do think that the quality of sightings are still high. I still, there's as much of an element of strangeness as there was 70 years ago. We did have some marked waves of UFOs, 1947, 1952, 1957, and then 1965 and 66 with the, so to speak, swamp gas sightings up in Michigan and that area that spurred, at that time, Congressman Gerald Ford to get congressional hearings on UFOs. So they did come in waves. And then the mid-70s, where Travis Walden got abducted, and, you know, the Pascagoula, Mississippi abductions, you know, that all happened during that period of time. So they're still coming. And, you know, I rely on the public of being the watchdog for me. And then I take those reports and scrutinize the best ones and try to make heads or tails out of them. And I pride myself as being more of a nuts and bolts ufologist, that I like to look at scientific data if I can. And if I see a case that's really good, I will look into getting radar data for it. And that is a really intensive effort, and it can be quite expensive. I spent thousands of dollars buying radar data from the FAA. And
Are they willingly giving that up, or are you having to fight through some red tape?
They seem to be willingly to give it up, but sometimes I think if they don't want to give it up, they put too many dollar signs on the data. And I really think they do that because I've had some pretty good evidence of that just in the past year, that I mentioned at the beginning of the show about the ladybug sightings down in Southern California, where it really generated some pretty unusual radar returns. Well, the gentleman that asked for that data got just reams of radar data, huge files, and they didn't charge him. And I got probably 0.10 of 1% of the data that he asked for, and they charged me $1,000. And it's the same FAA region, the same people. So figure that one out. I don't know what's going on, but the data that I asked for, this was a pretty mass sighting. It happened in December of 2017, where there were lines of blinking lights and several states all the way from the East Coast to Nevada reported these cases. And in my home state of Montana, there were 17 reports that night. And in Montana, you're lucky if you get two or three reports a month. And I asked for a 30 nautical mile radius of data, and they charged me $800 for it, and only for a half hour. And this guy asked for 3 hours of data for several hundred nautical mile radius and didn't get charged. So figure that one out. And these reports were never explained. I found out here in Montana, from the Air Force, from Air National Guard, which is the only military installation in Montana at the Great Falls Malmstrom Air Force Base, they had nothing, I repeat, nothing in the air that night. And the official explanation, which came out quite rapidly, is that they were C-17 and C-130 aircraft dropping paratroopers. And they flew all the way from several bases into Nellis Air Force test range and dropped these paratroopers. That generated all the UFO reports. Well, they didn't in Montana because there was nothing in the air that night. I got the unadulterated proof of that. And not only that, I found a range, an area of unidentified objects flying south-southeast about 35 knots. That has not been explained. Those were, some people, debunkers claimed they were birds. But December, you know, in Montana, bird migration, I have a bit of a problem with that. So anyhow, you know, that's kind of what's been happening in the last few years. But I always like to get my hands on a lot of data, but it does take a lot more time to analyze, particularly radar data. It's very intensive to unpack. It comes in different formats. And I have I don't know, I suppose above average computer expertise, but even some of it I've had problems with. And this current batch of data, I'm helping MUFON with it. But, you know, it's interesting, and, you know, it's always good to have a take a hard look at some of these cases. And you know, I mean, I've had cases where I've had video radar and eyewitness evidence, and that there's a high element of strangeness. What is it? You know, I don't know.
Well, tell us about some of your sightings. Let's go ahead and go into that. Tell us about some of your most intriguing sightings that you've been collecting.
Well, one that always sticks in my mind, I believe the date was March, right at the end of March of 2007, Dana Point, California, only a few miles south of Los Angeles International Airport. A gentleman was taking a walk. I believe it was a Sunday morning. He sees a dish-shaped craft, classic flying saucer, flying right over the ocean. He takes out his phone, and he snapped a shot of it, and this thing whisked away just in a blaze, just zip, and it was gone. And I got this photo. I've had people analyze that photo that lived in that area, and we thoroughly believed it was the real deal. You know, they're just no way of really explaining that case. And that's one that always sticks in my mind, you know, of getting a sighting of that magnitude. And, you know, the fact that I've got some forensic evidence. And of course, you know, that was close to Catalina Island, and there's been a lot of UFOs that have been seen coming out of the water off Catalina Island. And I don't know whether this particular object went in the water or not, but what he said was, is it was flying at jet speed, stopped and hovered long enough for him to take a photo, and then it continued on its journey at jet speed and was gone right away. So,
is that on your website?
Yes, it is.
That's amazing. That's also the area, you know, that you mentioned earlier about the Tic Tac UFO sighting.
That's right.
By the U.S. Navy. It seems to be a very active area. I would love to go out there myself and you know, for a couple of weeks and try to see something out there. I believe for some reason they're attracted to that area, or it may be true that, you know, many speculate that there is some type of underground or underwater base there. I know you've probably heard that, but yeah, those sightings always fascinate me when they happen out there. I'm wondering if it's because the military does so many exercises on that side of the country. What do you think about that?
That's a possibility. I really do think that UFOs have bases on Earth. As a matter of fact, they may have coexisted with us for centuries, extraterrestrial beings. And, you know, they've been seen coming in and out of the water. They've been seen coming in and out of the ground. They've been seen coming in out of volcanoes. And I believe, yeah, that there are UFO bases and underwater. And trying to prove that, I mean, you know, we got that Tic Tac military sighting and, you know, the infrared video that they took of it, which authenticates it even all the more. And, you know, I've got some of my own infrared equipment, thermal infrared imaging equipment, and one of my friends out on the West Coast who's an expert, and he buys these cameras on eBay and rebuilds them for contractors like Boeing and sells them to Boeing because they use them for developing aircraft and spacecraft. And you know, there are a lot of things flying around that we don't see. It might show up in a thermal infrared and you won't see it with the naked eye, and he sets these cameras out there and looks at them. So, but another case, continuing on with your question about best cases, and this is most interesting to me because we got a FOIA response, and I'm trying to remember the year of this. I believe it was right around the year 2000 or 2001, and there was some airline pilots that sighted a UFO off the Caribbean, out in the Caribbean, you know, off of Florida and Alabama. And one of my friends, Dr. Joe Ryan, who worked with me for years, he used to be chief scientist for the Air Force in NORAD. He was actually at Bentwaters after the big UFO incident over there. Didn't know anything about it because they transferred all the people out of Bentwaters to try to cover up that UFO incident in the early 80s. And Joe was one of the people that they assigned there. He was a civilian, but he wrote a Freedom of Information request to NORAD. And normally NORAD doesn't respond to anything. They sent back this FOIA request, and they talked about airline pilots, military pilots, saw a UFO, an object, come out of the water, go up to 40,000 feet, level off, and then fly into the continental U.S. And there were many sightings tracked all the way into the upper Midwest of that case. And that was a Freedom of Information request from NORAD. I actually made a copy of that request on my website. So that particular case often sticks out too, you know, of really a the real deal. You know, I mean, this is a government response, you know, of a UFO incident. And that one often sticks out as being a really authentic case. I believe that was around the year 2000 that happened. And I don't believe that they, according to the FOIA request, they didn't have it on radar. But, you know, who knows? You know, the thing about radar, and I kind of want your listeners to hear this, is that just because radar doesn't pick up something doesn't mean that it's not there. I mean, we have stealth aircraft, you know, the SR-71, the Beast, you know, the B, what is it, B-17, B-1, I'm trying to remember. Is it B-17 bomber?
Yes, yes.
B-1 bomber, F-17.
Yeah, that can't be picked up by radar. It can't be picked up by radar.
They're stealth aircraft, and they don't have a good radar cross sectional area. Well, look at a classic UFO. Look at a flying disc. A flying disc, I mean, a lot of people have seen them. If that disc is pointed parallel to the radar waves, radar is not going to pick it up. And who knows? I mean, they might have other type of diffraction that can diffract radar photons and not be picked up. But I will tell listeners this. I have seen plenty of evidence of UFO activity on radar. I mean, you can go look at just a regular radar screen. And when you look at a radar screen, you're looking at two type of echoes. You're looking at echoes that what we call secondary echoes, which are transponder beacons, where the radar sends out a beam and then it interrogates the transponder. Transponder sends back a beam. Okay, I'm United Flight 55 or whatever. And then there's what we call primary returns, uncorrelated primaries, we call them. These are just returns, could be a number of things. It could be close by the radar. It could be ground traffic, which can be picked up close to the radar. It could be radar ducting, super refraction, waves hitting the ground, coming back up from inversion layer, picking up ground targets. It could be birds in some instances. It could be aircraft that are not of an airplane that didn't file a flight plan. And the air is what we call a skin bait. And it could be a UFO. Now, I'd like to mention this about radar. I don't know whether you remember, or listen, probably several listeners do, there was a little gyrocopter, which is kind of a small helicopter that at best probably holds one person. This guy flew right up to the Capitol grounds and landed that gyrocopter on the grass by the Capitol building, right in the middle of the day. Well, you're saying, well, why didn't they have them on radar? You got a dense network of radars. I mean, if you ever looked at the radar returns from 9/11, I mean, they're just a dense radar. They don't see it because air traffic controllers are directing traffic. They're not looking for UFOs. Well, when they went back and looked at the data, sure, they found that gyrocopter. So these UFOs are across radar screens a lot of times. FAA, they're not looking for them. They're directing traffic. If they were looking for UFOs, airplanes would start colliding with one another. So I just want to let people know that just because, you know, people are looking at radar screens every day, why don't they see UFOs? Well, they're on there, and that gyrocopter is a great example of that.
Now, that's unreal, really.
Yep.
Talking about really driving it home, that drives it home, don't it?
Absolutely. Another case that sticks out to me, and I'm not even looking at my site because I've got hundreds of compelling cases. And I mentioned about UFO waves in the 70s. Well, this was actually, I believe, around, I don't know, 76, 77. And I got the case, of course, much after the fact. I mean, I didn't start investigating UFOs until 20 years later. And this was on the Yakima Indian Reservation, Yakima, Washington, south of Yakima. And a woman got a call from a neighbor, and the neighbor said, you need to go outside. There's a flying saucer out there. She walks outside, and there's a flying saucer hovering over this roadway, dirt road, gravel road, close to where she lived. She walks right under this thing. It was spinning and hovering, middle of the day, July 4th. I remember because it was July 4th, I think, 1976. Like, that was a 200 centennial. I mean, maybe E.T. was helping celebrate. I don't know. And she saw windows in this craft, and she saw people, humans, looked just like you and I. She saw a man with a white suit, white coat on, with a red necktie, a woman, which she said had 1950s, style glasses on. This craft was spinning, making no noise. She looks at it for several minutes. All of a sudden, it shoots off horizontally, shoots off vertically, and zip, it's gone in a matter of seconds. She signed a notarized document and sent it to me saying that she saw this thing. So, do you believe it? I mean, it's a Ripley's. Believe it or not, I think the actual name of the site was Matinash, Washington. It was south of Olympia, or south of Yakima. I'd have to really look at the exact, you know, town. It's on the reservation, Yakima Indian Reservation. And that's kind of been a hotbed of sightings for years. But, of course, another reason for that, there's a military maneuver area right close to Yakima, and that generates a lot of UFO reports, too. Yeah, both ground and air military. So that particular case sticks in my mind. And, you know, listeners can go and look at that, you know, kind of research that site on my old blog, on my old site, in which contains reports prior to 2011. And another case that sticks out to me, and this is sort of a, what I would call an electromagnetic case. A gentleman was a truck driver, driving cars. He had went up to the Denver area, and Hertz Rent-A-Car, a lot of times rent-a-car agencies will sell their cars, buy new ones. Well, some car dealers bought these cars. So he was trucking these cars back to Los Angeles. Well, no, not all of them. He had some en route places. And he is driving south, not too far from Roswell. I can't remember the name of that town. And it was in the middle of the night. He was on his way to El Paso, Texas. And he periodically likes to pull off the side of the road and check his load. And he did that. and it was a clear star, you know, lots of stars out. Of course, that's the desert. I don't recall exactly what time of the year it was, but he gets out of his truck, and all of a sudden he got this creepy feeling, and it felt like a hair was standing up, you know, in his arms and on his head. And all of a sudden his truck turns off, lights turn off. He had a flashlight in his hand, flashlight would work. And then he looks up and he sees a huge flying triangular craft, so big it was covered almost all the sky. He said you could just look up at this thing. He was just dumbfounded, didn't know what to do. He tried to start his truck, he couldn't. So he goes in back, and what he had done in the past in emergencies is he'd start up one of his cars, back it out off his truck, and then go get help. Well, he goes in, he couldn't start the car. So all of a sudden, this craft starts moving backward. His truck lights come on. And the lights on the car that he tried to start come on. And so he turned the car lights off and the car and back, jumped in his truck and got the heck out of there. He got to El Paso about 6 o'clock the next morning, dumped off some cars there. And this is the kicker. He had clocks in his truck, his watch, which is electronic, and he had one wind-up clock. All his wind-up clock was 13 minutes, I repeat, 13 minutes faster than all the other clocks. So either it was a time warp or it was electromagnetic interference that stopped all the electronic clocks or whatever happened. He drives on to Los Angeles. His nephew was a member of the Long Beach Police Department. He called his nephew found my number. He calls me a day later, and the guy was just really interesting. And I think I've actually got an audio tape on my side of the interview with him. But I'm trying to remember that town close to Roswell. It's not, I can't remember the name of it. And that's where he was, close to where he was when he had this particular sighting. And that one often sticks out in my mind. And another case, and this is an X-Files, I think your X-Files listeners, I'd almost classify this as an X-Files case. And I do have an X-File category on my website, by the way. Many cases that go into what I would call the X-File category. This was in the Big Island of Hawaii. And I believe it was around 2005. I was out of town actually doing a UFO talk at the time. And I got back and I had this voicemail, and this woman was in a panic. I called her right back. She said she hadn't slept for 2 nights. And on the Big Island, there's a lot of farms, and people have 10-acre lots, which is, I mean, that's a lot of property. And they have sort of their own farms. I mean, they raise, you know, I mean, Hawaii's a good climate. You can raise a lot of produce and other things there, fruit and vegetables. Well, her and her boyfriend were having dinner, and the dog came back and just was panic, and the dog just ran in the house and it crawled under the bed, and she couldn't get the dog to come out. So they went outside and they sat in their hot tub, and you know, they had, I think they had a drink, they weren't intoxicated. And all of a sudden, you know, and they were, she admitted it, they were passionate at the time, and they see these lights coming over the lawn close to the house. And they got out of the hot tub, and there were several red lights. And all of a sudden, these eyes come out of the lights, just like a periscope, right up to them, just scaring the crap out of them. And they didn't know what to do. And these things were alive, whatever they were. And she got on her cell phone talking to her brother. She walked up to the house, and one of these lights came right up to her when she's talking to her brother. And all of a sudden, the weather got freaky. It was drizzling. The skies were clear and everything. There was a drizzle coming out. And her and her boyfriend, this was like 5-10 minutes. And they were just in a panic. They got on their knees and prayed and closed their eyes. They got up, opened their eyes, and these things were gone. So figure that one out. I mean, she was in a total berserk panic. And I believe she called the police and they wouldn't respond. I'd have to check my report on that. So that's another one that sticks out in my mind over all the years. You know, you got to kind of look at it, but that one really stuck out for me as being a really unusual report. And I did classify it that being part of my X-Files. So those are some of the, you know, I could probably talk to you the rest of the night about reports, but those are the ones. There was another one, and I don't know, maybe we're running out of time, but this was south of St. Louis. I can't remember the exact name of the town, right across the Mississippi River. This was in Missouri. From Illinois, you know, the Mississippi River separates a number of states, two of being Missouri and Illinois. And this guy, his dogs went wild. That frequently happens around UFOs. And he saw these green lights over the Mississippi River. It was close to his house. So he goes out there. There's this huge green light hovering over the Mississippi River. And across the river is a sheriff. Local sheriff, and a lot of people are looking at this thing, and it was still hovering, and the sheriff kind of gave up, figured out what the heck this thing was, and the sheriff had just left, and this guy calls me, and he's looking at this thing while he's talking to me on his cell phone. Well, finally he hangs up, and they decided, the guy, he was talking to these guys on the Illinois side. I don't know how he got their number. I think they got in touch somehow, and they got in their jet skis, boats, took out after this thing, and they start shooting at this thing with shotguns and rifles, and all of a sudden all their boat engines turn off and this thing gets real bright and disappears. He calls me back, and I could hear him pushing his boat onto an island on the Mississippi River trying to get cover. So there's another high strain in this case. My advice is, don't shoot at anything that you don't know what it is. Don't shine a laser light. Of course, that can be dangerous. You can blind a pilot. So those are some of the cases that really stick out to me that, you know, that had a high element of strangeness that I believe were true reports just based on what I heard.
Yeah, fantastic. So, Paul, I do want to give you plenty of time, if you don't mind going over a little bit, because I know they're going to want to hear the O'Hara Airport incident in Chicago. If you don't mind to take us through that and what information you were able to collect about that.
Well, that case came to the National UFO Reporting Center, and that was Election Day, November 6th. November 7th, 2006. And there were some United Airline pilots out on the C concourse, and looking up and saw a dish-shaped craft hovering above the C concourse. So they called the United Airline dispatcher. United Airlines dispatcher talked to some other people on the ramp, and other people saw it. And one person, they were pushing a craft onto the hangar, a craft that they were going to work on, do maintenance on. And they saw the craft hovering. And all of a sudden, this craft shoots straight up and cuts a hole in the overcast. And there was a very low cloud ceiling, about 1,000 feet above ground level. And I determined through my research with NARCAP, which you mentioned at the beginning of the show, I got associated. That's how I found out about this case, is Dr. Richard Haynes, who at the time was the head scientist for NARCAP, got me involved because I was, you know, I had meteorological and radar expertise. And we looked at the meteorological data, and I determined through satellite cloud tops that those clouds were 10,000 foot thick. This thing cut a hole in it, just a circular hole. And it would take an amazing amount of energy, cut a hole in that cloud. And that cloud, that hole filled up as with, you know, just regular advection and diffusion. And so the United Airlines dispatcher called the tower, and the tower kind of made a big joke out of it. You know, Sue, you've been drinking, or you're celebrating Thanksgiving earlier, or whatever. And we got a copy of all those tapes, plus some of the radar data. And the FAA actually issued a notice to airmen that were landing to be watch out for UFO that was close to the runway, because they considered it a safety. I mean, you got something hovering in a high traffic area, you know, with low cloud ceilings, very, very big danger. And allegedly other pilots saw this thing. And, you know, there's been photos that have came out, and we don't never really known if they're hoax photos or real photos. Allegedly, Dan Aykroyd, who's the comic, has a real video of this thing. I've never seen it. It what, you know, as far as our analysis of what did the radar data show, the aviation radar data didn't indicate anything, but the Doppler weather radar did show an unusual return about a third of a mile of where the United Airlines people saw this thing. So is it confirmation? I don't know. I'd hesitate to say it. But Doppler radar, and Doppler radar is not really set up to pick up UFOs because it has a narrow beam width. But if a UFO happens to fly or even hover, Doppler radar will pick it up. And also another thing about radar, aviation radar has what we call a moving target indicator, and it does not pick up stationary targets. The FAA doesn't want to look at stationary targets. They're looking at aircraft. So, I mean, eyewitness reports said this is hovering. So if it was, aviation radar wouldn't pick it up. But Doppler radar would, because it will pick up stationary targets. So is that confirmation? I'd say it's kind of interesting, put it that way. So, you know, it's a case where you've got very high credibility witnesses seeing this thing. We do have some forensic data, the weather data, the meteorological data, the fact that this thing cut a hole in the clouds, and it took an immense amount of energy, that it would take a flying, a 747 flying nearly Mach 1, you know, several seconds, amount of energy it would have took to blow a hole in this cloud. That's happened before with UFOs. This is not the only UFO incident that's happened. But, you know, there's a lot of data, a lot of credibility, and you know, I can't remember the name of the newspaper reporter, John Hilgovich was a newspaper reporter for the Chicago Times, wrote a big article on this. And, you know, he interviewed several people about it. And, you know, to get in the Chicago Times, it was quite a bit later. I believe his article came out right around the new year of 2007. John Hilgovich's article in the Chicago Times. So, you know, that's kind of a nutshell of what I found. And I'm not the only one that did research. I mean, with NARCAP, Dr. Haynes, there were a couple of NASA scientists that worked, some physicists that worked on that case, retired air traffic controllers that worked on that case, radar experts, so pilots that worked on that case. And we had something like 110-page report, which people could get on the NARCAP website. And that report was sent to all members of Congress. And I don't believe anybody responded, but, you know, it was definitely an unidentified and something that compromised aviation safety and controlled airspace right at the time. You know, I believe that was around 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. So, I mean, UFOs are definitely a safety feature, you know, when it comes to traffic. So that's kind of the conclusion that I drew in my involvement in the O'Hare incident. And again, people can go to my website. The quickest way, a lot of these cases that I discussed with you tonight, is go to my main website, UFOs Northwest, which is www.ufosnw.com, and then click on reports, and then there's archive reports. Click on archive reports and you get to my old site, and all these cases that I discussed with you tonight are on that site, and you can find them by doing a search. You can go by state, by year, and a number of things, and find these compelling sightings. So that was a very good report, something I was very proud to be a part of. And you know, I could talk about many others, but that's kind of what I would, best I could tell you in a short period of time about the O'Hare incident.
I'm definitely going to have you come back on the show, William. In the meantime, I will have all your links in the show notes. And so I will drive my people over there and encourage them to check out your website on a regular basis, because I know you do this all the time. And before we go, would you like to tell my listeners anything about whatever you're working on right now?
Oh, I've got a number of cases sitting in my in basket right now. I mean, I just posted a couple of cases. A lot of your listeners probably got Ring doorbells, and, you know, I mean, there's a few creatures out there or whatever that are causing the Ring doorbell motion detector to go off and people's cell phones to beep. And I think I've got these cases explained, but they are interesting. And if people go to my homepage, UFOs Northwest, www.ufosnw.com, they'll see the links and the videos of these two particular cases. And, you know, I've got a recent case of, I believe this is off the East Coast, of a UFO with two lights on it. That's really very interesting. And I have the newest cases that are interesting with photos and or videos are on my homepage. People can scroll down. And then I've got a top case category. So those are some of the very recent cases that I've posted. And they are on the homepage. And I update every day. I'll probably put one or two cases on later on tonight. And I'm updating every day. So I encourage your listeners, if they want the latest and the greatest reports, to visit my site. Because I will say this about me, my site. I get reports up there probably faster than anybody around. So I don't get as many, but I get them up there faster.
Very good. Many blessings. I really appreciate your time.
I'm as glad to be here, and I look forward to your listeners checking my site out and talking with you in the future.
Okay, so another one comes to a close, and I want to thank my special guest, William Puckett, for joining me again. If you're into the latest UFO sightings, you want to see the pictures and the videos, William has it all on his website. Make sure that you go check that out, and I'll have the link in the show notes and also on the Mysterious Radio website. I want to thank my producer tonight, Kim, Mysterious Radio team. I am your host, K-Town. I want you to have the best night, and I will see you next time on Mysterious Radio.
Like the show? Get more Mysterious Radio on our website. And don't forget to visit our Twitter and Facebook page.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. In Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board. In Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is! Drawing board or...
Miro! All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
For a limited time, visit Miro.com/brainstorm now and get a free business plan trial to unlock even more brainstorming tools like private mode and voting. That's Miro.com/brainstorm now.